from Euros Worldwide, this is FSN.
And thanks very much, Oliver Barrett. It's Monday, the 25th of March, 2019. Are you well? Thanks for choosing the Richie Allen Show. Thanks to Hayden Hewitt for sorting out the streaming issues. What a man he is. Triggerwarning.tv, liveleak.com. Great stuff, Hayden. Cheers, pal. Yeah, it's Monday. It's been a beautiful day here in South Manchester. I hope it's been lovely wherever you are. Got a top show for you today. Loads to talk about. Welcome to it.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Helen Saxby is a feminist writer and blogger, and I connected with Helen a couple of weeks ago on Twitter. I think she's got some important things to say about trans activism and how dangerous it's getting when police officers are turning up to people's houses to question them over misgendering. But there are other issues as well. Safety of women, vulnerable women, at women's shelters and refuges. Why are these shelters saying that trans women or men who identify as women can go to these shelters? Surely that's not good for women there. Maybe women fleeing domestic abuse or sexual abuse. We'll talk to Helen Saxby this hour. And the former BBC journalist and the host of the brilliant politics show on BCFM, Tony Gosling, live from Bristol in the second hour. A year on from the Skripal saga, the Novichok poisoning. Forget Where's Waldo? Where's the Skripals? Where are they? Plus much more from Tony Gosling in the second hour of your Richie Allen Show. Tweets, as usual, to my Twitter handle. Yes. Alright. Where is Waldo? Where are the Skripals? Has anybody seen the Skripals? We'll get into some of that with Tony and much more in the second hour. Indeed we will. So, I know you're expecting an avalanche of Brexit stuff. You're not going to get it. I've got a little bit of Brexit stuff to do. It was a weekend of marches, wasn't it? London and Glasgow. The European Union, of course, on the agenda. We had 1 million people, allegedly, in London, demanding a second referendum on Brexit. And Scottish indie campaigners, or independence campaigners, Indie Ref 2 campaigners, marched in Glasgow yesterday. I've never been to Glasgow. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? I've been to Edinburgh, which is beautiful, but not to Glasgow. I should make it my business to visit that city, of course. Anyway, Indie Ref 2 campaigners want independence from London so that they can hand it over to Brussels. The mind boggles. Ooh, aye, ochanu. Ochanu. That's rubbish, isn't it? That's absolute garbage. I'll leave that one there. So Theresa May addressed Parliament today saying she doesn't have enough support to win a vote on her EU withdrawal deal as things stand, due to bring it back for the third time. It was suggested it might happen tomorrow, Tuesday, but it won't. It might be much later on in the week. She said she would continue trying to get MPs to back it before she would put it to the Commons. The Prime Minister will also order Tory Members of Parliament to vote against a bid by a group of MPs to hold votes on alternatives to her plan. This is being headed up by Sir Oliver Letwin, who's another Tory MP. He wants to schedule a series of indicative votes whereby Parliament could basically, through a voting process, decide which way it wants to go with this Brexit mess. But she said she will order her own MPs to vote against that, saying she was very sceptical about that process even. May said the government would commit to delivering the outcome of the votes, but would... Excuse me. May said the government would not commit to delivering the outcome of any such votes, but that the government would engage constructively with members of Parliament. The votes could lead to an outcome that is unnegotiable with the European Union, said May. So it's an absolute mess, as you know. The only certain thing is that the UK is never going to leave the European Union. DUP leader Arlene Foster told May on the phone earlier that the DUP would not be backing her deal. May said in Parliament the default outcome remained leaving with no deal, but that's not likely either. She said the alternative is to pursue a different form of Brexit or a second referendum. The bottom line remains, said Theresa May, if the House doesn't approve the withdrawal agreement this week and isn't prepared to countenance leaving with no deal, we would have to seek a longer extension, meaning the country would hold European elections. Oh, yeah. Nobody was happy with this, of course. Nobody was happy. The DUP's Nigel Dodds was raging. Jeremy Corbyn was spitting feathers. That's the leader of the opposition. Hilary Benn was sarcastically chuntering away there as May was speaking. And the leader of the Scottish Nationals in Westminster, Ian Blackford, stood up to speak. But nobody, let alone me, could make head nor tail of what Scottish National Party leader in Westminster, Ian Blackford, was saying. Nobody had a Scooby-Doo. Yeah, that's Labour and Tory backbenchers laughing at Ian Blackford. You have to be of a certain vintage to laugh at that, or an idiot like me. So what's going on then? Just one more time. To be fair, that could be any Scottish National Party MP in Westminster. Anyway, Kate McCann of Sky News tried to put it into a bit of perspective. What happened today? Where are we going? What's happening, Kate?
The Prime Minister has to bring her deal back to the Commons this week, and you heard her there saying at the moment she doesn't have enough support to do that, although she intends to bring it forward for a vote by the end of the week. If she can get it through that vote, then she can have an extension until the end of March. That's been agreed with May, sorry, that's been agreed with the European Union. If she can't do that, then we move on to another deadline, which is the 12th of April, and that's the point at which the UK has to say that it is going to take part in EU elections or effectively leave without a deal. But I think the most interesting thing that's just come out of that Prime Minister's statement is that she is talking tough to the ERG, her Conservative Brexiteers, and the DUP for the first time. She said, effectively, no deal isn't going to happen unless Parliament votes for it or unless Parliament wants it to happen. Now, that is a significant change of tone. In the past couple of weeks, she has warned that a no-deal Brexit would be the result if MPs didn't back her deal. That's effectively been the way she's been trying to force them to vote for her plan. And you heard Nigel Dodds there. He's the DUP MP. He said, well, this is the first time I'm hearing this. Why is the Prime Minister not prepared for no deal? Why is the government not ready? He's really angry, and Steve Baker and others seemingly similarly angry on Twitter too. They feel like the Prime Minister is for the first time trying to say to them, if you don't vote for my deal, you don't get any Brexit. And you heard her there in that statement saying, my deal, no Brexit or slow Brexit. That's with a very long extension. And that's what happens if she can't get her vote through this week.
Okay, so she needs to have the vote through by this week because the 29th of March was when we were supposed to leave. It can't roll over into next week?
No. That's because Donald Tusk at the EU Council meeting last week said the vote has to go through this week, which I admit does seem a little bit strange given that we have until the 12th of April.
Yeah.
But I think that's because there has to be a process by which the UK takes part in EU elections. So it's not like the government could turn around on the 12th of April and say, actually, you know what, we will take part in these elections. That's the very final deadline. If the vote hasn't been passed by the end of this week, there needs to be time for that process to take place.
Donald Tusk said, you can't do it next week, you've got to do it now. And May jumped and leapt and ran to do what she was told, because Parliament and the UK government, whether it's a Labour government, whether it's a Tory government, whether it's a coalition, are not running things. They're not running the country. And that's basically it in a nutshell. You mightn't have understood a word there, Kate McCann said. If you didn't, you didn't. If you did, you did. William has been on to me. And William is Scottish. And he said, it's Och I the New. Get it right, Richie. Och I the New. Cheers, William. And I do promise never to say that ever again. Paul tweets, if we lived in a just world, the SNP's reputation would be in tatters after Nicola Sturgeon was photographed smiling with Alastair Campbell on Saturday's march. I did see such a tweet. I did see such a photograph. These people are sick, Paul. They're sick. All of them, particularly those at the top of the their parties, you know, the leaders of parties, the deputy leaders, they are sick people, twisted, sick-minded people. Nicola Sturgeon is sick. First of all, to be photographed with Alastair Campbell, a mass murderer, number one. But number two, to demand independence from London in order to hand it then over to Brussels. You know, and what that would inevitably mean for Scotland in the future in the next 5 to 10 years. Coming up for 14 minutes past the hour. Let's forget about Brexit for the moment anyway. According to the Israeli Defence Forces, seven people were injured after a rocket fired from the Gaza Strip hit a house belonging to a British Israeli family in central Israel. I'm sceptical about this claim, by the way. And it's not because I'm completely one-sided on this issue and back the Palestinians. I'm not saying that rockets are not sporadically or intermittently fired from Gaza. I'm not saying that. But it's the timing of this. The timing of this. And by the way, Wile E. Coyote has better rockets than the Palestinians. And that's not a cheap gag, right? Darts are more accurate than the rockets that the Palestinians have. You'd be better off getting Michael Van Gerwen to stand inside Gaza, throwing darts, he'd do more damage than the Palestinians, right? So apparently at 25 past 5 this morning, a rocket came down and it injured seven people. Thankfully nobody was killed, that's important. Bibi Netanyahu, one of the craziest, you know, Yosemite Sam mad feckers that ever walked the face of the earth, said that Israel would respond with force. He's got plenty of fish to be frying at the moment with investigations into his own conduct. He's got all sorts of problems. He's looking for a distraction, I reckon, Nutty Yahoo. And not to mention the fact it's been 5 years now since so-called Operation Protective Edge, when the Israelis murdered 2,000 Palestinians, including 500 children. So they're due now to carpet bomb Gaza again. So I would watch Gaza very closely. And I've never suggested that the beleaguered Palestinians or Hamas have not fought back and have not launched rockets into Israel. I have never said that, so don't jump down my throat. But I think the timing of this particular claim is very pertinent. Watch it closely. Watch it closely. There's been a survey by the Home Office, dear listener, that suggests that Islamophobia is everywhere in the UK. It has seeped into the public consciousness, apparently. And British far-right membership is growing. And this is according to a poll conducted by the Home Office. Now, the Home Office claims there were 94,100 hate crimes recorded in England and Wales in the year 2017 to 2018. And they're saying that there was a 40% surge in religiously aggravated hate crime. I don't like this hate crime paradigm. I don't like it, of course. A crime is a crime. Trying to tag on hate crime to it and all of that nonsense. I've talked a lot about that on the programme. Apparently, it's an anti-Muslim prejudice and the driving forces behind it are Brexit and far-right types capitalising on divisions in the country to spread messages of hate and prejudice. It's very interesting to me. And you know I've got no time for the far-right and the knuckle-dragging goons that follow them around the country, these absolute morons who can't string three sentences together and have no grasp of what's really going on and why, and sing football songs to a little muppet wearing a green flight jacket who claims to be a public speaker and a journalist, and he's just a wife beater and a thug. It's mad, the world, isn't it? It's totally mad. But it's not on the rise, really, I would suggest, number one. And number two, why, when they make these claims, do they not give an example of what spreading a message of hate really is. Give me an example. Show me a message of hate so that I will know in the future that it is a message of hate. What is a hate message? Please, somebody help me out here. Please, send me one. Send me a hate message against big, ignorant, baldy Irishmen. Send me one now so that I'll know what a hate message is in the future. These are crazy times. Crazy times. You know, if it's not Islamophobia, it's anti-Semitism. If it's not anti-Semitism, it's transphobia. It's homophobia. It's crazy. That was in the Telegraph today. Made no sense to me. This will make you laugh. This was in the Telegraph as well. Victoria Ward writing in the Telegraph. You're going to scratch your head when you hear this one. A soldier has been charged after going rogue on the battlefield. Now that's serious, right? He went rogue on the battlefield. What did he do? Well, apparently he killed his own comrades and he drove his car into other cars. He was a crazy fecker and he has been charged. Guess what though? It was in a virtual war game. I kid you not. The soldier has been formally charged by the army. He's a rifleman based in Edinburgh after going rogue in a virtual scenario. He got so bored of playing a computer game as part of his training that for the laugh he started shooting his own teammates and driving his virtual tank into virtual cars. And they have charged him. They found him guilty. And I believe he's been confined to his barracks and has been given guard duties to do. This is crazy stuff. A Ministry of Defence spokesperson said, "We take the training of our service personnel seriously and anyone who is disruptive to the training receives disciplinary action. Virtual reality training programmes are able to deliver greater flexible training and replicate complex scenarios, allowing for rapid experimentation, development of tactics and ability to test new vehicles in multiple environments." It's crazy, huh? All those researchers over the years who talked about virtual reality and transhumanism and all of this coming down the line and people merging their brains with a super cloud and all of that. It's happening. This guy got so cheesed off with it, not being out in the pissing rain in the Scottish Highlands doing proper exercises, that he decided to just go mental. I've done it myself. I used to play Double Dragon years ago and I used to like playing it on my own, you know. And then some kid would come along and stick 10p in the game to join in with me and I just kick him to death so that I could play on my own. So I totally understand it. Go away. Leave me alone. I'm going to clear this game on my own, Double Dragon. Mental stuff, right? Michael Wilshaw, Sir Michael Wilshaw, who's a former inspector of schools in the UK, chief inspector, said that LGBT rights lessons should be reinstated despite parents' protests. I know you've been following this. It's been all over the news. The No Outsiders programme, which is basically getting very young children to learn about LGBT rights, amazingly, has been blocked in schools in Birmingham. 5 schools. You know this because it's been all over, as I said, all over the news and the press. So Michael Wilshaw says people have to accept they were living in this country with the values that this country holds. These are schools that said it was age inappropriate to be teaching primary school kids about LGBT rights, but also that it was incompatible with Islam. Now, of course, it's also incompatible with Christianity. At least I think it is anyway. I'm not a practicing Christian and I don't care what you are. Whether you're gay, straight, bi, trans, I couldn't give a damn. And I know you couldn't either, dear listener. But anyway. So this guy, Michael Wilshaw, said, look, these lessons are going to have to start regardless of what the parents think. And on BBC Radio 4 this morning, I don't have the clip, but I've got the text. He said, these people that have these very conservative views sincerely held have also got to accept that they are living in this country with the values that this country holds. They can't break the law, and the law says people should be treated equally. And he goes on to say, and this is the crux of it, this is the worrying thing, he said, We live, and I quote him now, Michael Wilshaw, we live in a very diverse society, in a society which respects people no matter what their faith, no matter what their ways of life, and children need to know that they need to balance those two issues. And if the parents are not teaching them to balance those two issues, then schools need to. Eh? Eh? It's no laughing matter, is it? I'm going to be speaking with Helen Saxby in a minute, and the story I'm going to be speaking, well, we're going to cover quite a bit with Helen, but story in the Daily Mail today, again, I know you'll have been following this story. This is a story about Caroline Farrell. She's a Catholic woman, Caroline, and the Daily Mail reports that she is unrepentant over calling a transgender woman he and claiming the teenager was mutilated, as she describes the terrifying moment police came to her door. Now, Caroline Farrell was reported to the police after she called a transgender woman he in a tweet, right? She was told she was under investigation for using the wrong pronoun for charity chief Susie Green's 23-year-old daughter. Now, that daughter had gender reassignment surgery in Thailand when she was 16. Surrey police later dropped the probe, but they had gone to Caroline Farrow's house. She said she was terrified. Now, she was on Good Morning Britain earlier with Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan, and she describes the moment that the police came around. So have a listen to this, and we'll pick this up in a few minutes with Helen Saxby. Caroline Farrow reported to the police for misgendering.
The first thing they said to me was, following an appearance with Susie Green on Good Morning Britain, you made a series of, and the first thing I thought was, oh my goodness, I'm going to be interviewed over something I said on television, you know, for sort of 6 months later. They said, you made a series of tweets in which you misgendered Susie Green's daughter. And I was absolutely staggered for two reasons. Firstly, I have a tweet cleaner on my account, which automatically deletes tweets, I think, after every 2 weeks. It might be 10 days, but... So Susie Green has said I deleted the tweets as though I was ashamed of them. No, I wasn't. I just couldn't remember what they were. And secondly, I couldn't believe that I was going to be interviewed under caution for misgendering, which is not a crime. And at the same time, Surrey police were very well aware I had been the subject of a horrendous campaign of stalking and intimidation that went way above and beyond anything I had said. And they've done nothing.
And that's for other stuff.
Sure. So, yeah, no, so my reaction, I was terrified. I was shaking. I couldn't breathe. The room was spinning. I was, you know...
How many children do you have?
I have five children.
So you, and you were presumably thinking the worst-case scenario is I might go to prison here and my kids won't have their mother because I have misgendered somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought... They're going to try and make a test case out of this one because I know that there have been a number of other individuals who've had charges brought against them.
You're actually talking about two people having fundamentally different points of view and then arguing with each other on Twitter, and that leading to the police coming around saying you've been reported for misgendering. And we know that in some cases the police have asked people to accept the caution. Now, I've got to put a disclaimer here. I'm not a solicitor, not a lawyer, and I couldn't claim to be an expert in the law. But I would advise any man or woman listening to this programme, if a police officer ever asks you to accept a caution, I would decline. Let it play out. Let the police officer or officers return back to base and file their report, and if they decide to, send it to the Director of Public Prosecutions. Don't accept a caution, because it's pretty close to accepting a legal acceptance on your behalf that you've, you know, committed an infraction of the law of sorts. Don't accept a caution. Don't. Somebody says to you, you misgendered somebody, or you told somebody that they're not really a woman, they're a man. You should accept a caution from us. No. I would say no, but I would put the caveat, don't necessarily listen to me because I ain't a lawyer or a solicitor. But tell you what I would be doing in that instance. I would be telling, very politely, of course, don't be insulting people in uniform in this day and age when they're looking for an excuse to arrest people. I would very politely say, listen, the conversation is over. I'm not accepting any caution. Please leave and close your door. See what happens then. This is your Richie Allen Show. It's Monday. Have I got a terrific week of programmes lined up for you? Well, you know I do. Terrific programmes coming this particular week. Helen Saxby joins the programme in a minute to talk about the protection of vulnerable women in women's shelters and also the legalities of misgendering. Welcome to the programme, Monday, March 25th, back in a couple of minutes. Right, music from Simple Minds on the Richie Allen Show. It's exactly 5:30. It's live, of course, archived on Spotify and iTunes a bit later on. This kind of came up a couple of years ago, and it came out of nowhere. We've talked to gay and lesbian women on this programme about the struggle for gay rights back in the 1970s and 1980s. We've read people like Andrew Pearce in the Daily Mail, and many gay, lesbian and trans people of a certain age are bewildered by some of the things they're reading in the newspapers and seeing on television. The fact that people have been visited by the police, as we heard a couple of minutes ago, for allegedly misgendering someone is scary enough. But when you read articles about women's shelters and refuges around the country that were set up to give some place to go for women who are the victims of domestic violence or sexual abuse, some place for them to go and be anonymous and get their lives back together. And then you read that many of these places are now saying that they will, you know, accept trans women. We all know the story, of course, last year of the trans woman, a man who identified as a woman, who went to a woman's prison and raped several women there. What's going on? Well, to help me understand this a little better, I want to welcome to the programme a feminist writer and blogger. And you can read her, and she's very interesting. She's at notthenewsinbriefs.wordpress.com. Notthenewsinbriefs.wordpress.com. I will put a link to that on Twitter, and I'll get Rog to put one on Facebook a bit later on. Delighted to welcome Helen Saxby to the programme. Helen, you're very welcome. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for the plug for my blog.
Not at all. Great. Not at all. We'll give plenty of plugs to it between now and the top of the hour. We'll give a few more plugs as well. I'm often wrong, right? I am often wrong. But I'm not wrong in saying this has come almost out of the blue in the last couple of years. And it's even... Go ahead, Helen. Go ahead.
No, I'm really interested that you say that because, of course, it's not quite out of the blue for feminists who have been talking and writing about this for many, many years. I've been writing about it for the last 4 or 5 years, but there are people before me like Julie Bindle, Sheila Jeffries, people who actually particularly lesbian feminists who saw the writing on the wall that way back in 2004 when the original Gender Recognition Act put a sort of legal fiction that a man could be a woman, which is biologically impossible. It was put into law solely to help a very tiny number of transsexuals for whom, because we didn't have equal marriage at the time, could not marry in their preferred gender. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And then since then, we've had the Equality Act. Women are protected under the category sex, and trans people are protected under the category of gender reassignment. And then in recent years, there's been a lot of work behind the scenes from transgender lobby groups who want to have an easier way of getting their preferred gender into a kind of legal framework where they can have all of the documents that they need, including their original birth certificate in the gender that they prefer to live in. And that resulted in the Trans Inquiry of 2015. Stop me if you're getting bored.
No, this is hugely interesting. This is great context, Helen. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll be as brief as I can. But the Women and Equalities Committee, led by Maria Miller, instigated the Trans Inquiry, and they had a lot of written evidence from lots of women, lots of women's groups, lots of trans people, lots of trans groups, and they invited in to give verbal evidence. I think it was about 15 trans groups and then a few more neutral sort of health groups and no women's groups at all. And they subsequently gave out a report in the beginning of 2016 which basically recommended all of the changes that the trans lobby groups wanted without any of the caution that feminist groups and women's groups are giving over things like single-sex spaces, places that have been fought for by women for decades, and that women need. The kind of caution over those sorts of things wasn't taken into account because women's groups weren't listened to.
Well, you've answered, you've answered my next question, because my next question would have been, what were the worrying changes at the time? And you're saying that spaces exclusively reserved for women. This is obviously a big deal.
It's a really big deal. I remember some years ago when Trevor Phillips was head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, I remember being really struck by something he said, which was that women need women-only spaces in order to level the playing field in an unequal society. So it's not something extra for women. It's simply to make things equal. So, for example, because 98% of sex crime is committed by males and the majority of victims are women and girls, women and girls need those spaces where they can just be with women, where there aren't any males, and it's been proven and shown that women recover better in those single-sex spaces. That's been established. We all thought that was done and dusted, and apparently now it's not. It's up for grabs again, that it's okay to have males in those spaces if the male in question identifies as female. So that's taken away in one fell swoop the rights that women had fought for years, you know, because women actually need those rights.
And in my introduction, I mentioned, and I didn't just get it from your Twitter page. I mean, I have been on your Twitter. By the way, Helen is at Helen Saxby 11, so it's at Helen Saxby even, at Helen Saxby 11. Follow Helen on there and the blog.
That's the one,
And not the news and briefs.wordpress.com. So, I mean, that's a massive thing. And in the introduction, I mentioned that more and more shelters are saying, yes, the trans woman in need of assistance can come here. And it's not, you know, it's not a small number of shelters and refuges. It seems to be a great deal of them around the country.
Yeah, I live in Brighton, which is a really progressive place, and I love it for that. It's very diverse, very, you know, it's a lovely place to live, very alternative. In Brighton, there are no longer any women-only services.
None.
This is like one of the most progressive places in the country to live, and there are no women-only services. I mean, I think that is despicable, actually. I think when women, you know, have been subject to male violence or, you know, sexual violence, or they're trying to escape domestic abuse, they need a place to go where they can be sure there won't be any males. So, you know, women are, it's a whole different ball game if you've got males present. So, you know, women need to have the sort of safety of the space where they can speak to other females who they're likely to have more empathy and sympathy and understanding from.
I can't get my head around that, to be honest. And, you know, supposed to maintain some level of objectivity, I can't. I can't get my head around it. I mentioned that horrendous case last year where, you know, it was shown that a trans woman, a man who identifies as a woman, committed rape while on remand. Look, there are people listening to this programme. To describe my politics, Helen, totally, I'm an old champagne socialist, right? That's who I am. That's the truth. You know, my thinking would be on the left. I have a lot of listeners whose politics are on the right or centre-right, and they will say, obviously, without a hint of patronising you at all, they will say, this is obviously a very bright lady here. Why can't she see the contradiction in terms of progressive politics? Surely, when progressive politics is followed to its conclusion, you get the lunacy that you're experiencing in Brighton. Progressive is not maybe all it's cracked up to be as an ideology. What do you think?
I understand what you're saying, and I think there's an awful lot of women who are on the left who consider themselves to be progressive, who are liberal, who are tolerant, who are very much behind human rights for everybody, And this has been a kind of curveball thrown at us all, because it's actually thrown up some there's a lot of women on the left who are uncomfortable, to say the least, to be seen to be agreeing with people on the right over this. I know. It is an uncomfortable. There are some uncomfortable bedfellows, I can tell you, in the sort of, you know.
Helen, before we talk about the police, let me stay on this for a minute, because this is important. I don't often get to get into this with somebody who's got an academic approach like yourself, so it's a pleasure to be talking about this with you, genuinely. So identity politics, then, it's incredibly negative then, isn't it? I mean, because what you're describing is a real phenomenon here. I know this because I have friends of mine from the old Socialist Workers' Party and, you know, left-leaning parties, the Labour Party in Ireland, and they're saying, I can't believe it that... You know, I'm finding myself in a very kind of a weird predicament. I'm actually retweeting something from the person on the right. But isn't that the kind of thinking that gets us into this mess, this progressive mess that I'm talking about, kind of forcing things on people, forcing diversity on people? Listen, Helen, I'm an Irish guy living in England. I don't care if the person living next door to me is from Pakistan, India, from Outer Hebrides. I couldn't give a damn. But when you force people that they have to accept things and they have to think a certain way, don't we end up then with the sort of lunacy that we're seeing with trans activism? You know, like creating vulnerable groups all the time and telling people, oh, you've got to tiptoe on eggshells around those people. Or maybe I'm not making any sense. What do you think?
You are kind of making sense. Identity politics, in my view, has a certain amount of justification. We are all different. We all have our different needs. There are intersections of different things that affect us that affect whether we are we have our own prejudices or people are prejudiced against us. So yes, and yet taken too far, you can see that it completely decimates any kind of group analysis or class analysis that you might use to help groups of people. And I think it's not helpful. And going back to the women's safe spaces as an example, we're looking at women needing safe spaces from men, not because all men are violent.
Of course, yeah.
It's absolutely because some men are violent. We don't know. We can't always tell which ones. And therefore, society has decided as to treat women as a whole group and to treat men as a whole group. And to keep them separate where women might be vulnerable. So in states of undress or in situations where they have experienced trauma, for example. So we treat those two groups of people as groups. Now, if we start to look at individuals, and there's always been a joke in the feminist community where there'll be women saying, yeah, but, you know, my Nigel wouldn't do that. You know, it's kind of not my Nigel.
Yeah.
And of course he wouldn't. He's lovely. But we have to have them in those rules in place to keep women safe from men who aren't your Nigel, and the men that wouldn't consider ever raping a woman or abusing a woman. Those men, I would hope, would understand that we needed those things in place, that there's some very, very decent men out there who absolutely agree that women need those spaces, because there are some awful men out there, and it's not a reflection on, it's not all men.
Of course not.
So what I'm saying is that within those groups that we broadly make policy for, not everybody is the same in those groups. But it helps us to make the policy to keep people safe.
Helen Saxby is our guest. It's a very important point you've made there. And again, I can't see a logical argument for allowing men who identify as women. And I don't say that to be cheap or to be hurtful, although it does anger me, this notion that I might be hauled up or I might get a ban because I refuse to accept that somebody who was born a man with male genitalia will ever be a woman. I never accept that. Helen Saxby is our guest. Read her blog. It's notthenewsinbrief.wordpress.com, and it's at HelenSaxby11 on Twitter. Scary times. Very interesting to see older gay and lesbian journalists writing about this, supportive of the points of view you've made there. Even creepier when somebody can be subjected to a visit from the police because of misgendering. This is the very definite. I don't want to remotely be sensational, because I don't think you can over-sensationalise this, but this is the very definition of introducing thought crime as an idea to society. I'm not a Christian, Helen. I was brought up a Catholic boy in Waterford in Ireland. I consider myself to be decent. I'm a humane bloke. I'm an easygoing fella. I'm very simple. I don't believe that somebody that was born with male anatomy is a woman. But I'm a nice fella, you know. If you want me to, but you know, call you by a female name, and I'm happy enough for you to wear women's clothes, I've no problem with that. How could I? None of my business. But when I'm told that, I have to think and I have to believe that it is really a woman, and that if I say otherwise, I might get a visit from the old Bill. This is this is Orwellian stuff, isn't it?
I think it's a mixture of Orwell and Kafka and The Handmaid's Tale, all into one, actually, as far as I can see. The Mermaid, the group who brought this latest one, and they brought them before. They brought a case against Posy Parker. Graham Linehan has been taken down this police station. And a couple of weeks ago, Miranda Yardley, who is actually a transsexual, was also in court, and that was somebody who was also employed by Mermaids. All these cases have been thrown out. But the worrying thing is that groups like Mermaids are actually training our police. It's not just Mermaids, it's Stonewall. Stonewall used to be the good guys.
Helen, clarify.
Sorry
to interrupt, Helen. A thousand apologies for the interruption.
Yes.
Mermaids training the police. Clarify that for me, because that will be news. It's news to me. I didn't realise there was that level of a relationship between them and the police. You might think I haven't done my research, but I didn't know that. Clarify that for me. So this pro-trans lobbying group are basically training the police to do what?
They're training them in trans awareness. So they're training the police to be inclusive and to understand trans issues. Now, as far as it goes, if you were, say, training the police on how to understand lesbian, gay, bi people, then that's one thing. But if you're training the police to understand trans issues, and one of the things that you're training them to do is to see misgendering as a hate crime, then that's obviously got an impact on other people's rights. As far as I'm concerned, I'm like you. I absolutely would say that anybody has a right to dress and to present themselves the way that they're happy with, and I would be polite, and it wouldn't bother me at all.
No.
What does bother me is when it conflicts with my rights to have my own beliefs, and I don't believe that a man becomes a woman, no matter how much surgery he has, and surgery actually is something that is not that common. I think around about 80% of men who transition don't have any surgery. So we're not even looking at a kind of a biological attempt to change sex. We're looking at much more superficial things like clothing and names and pronouns. And I think, as you know, my right to have my belief, which is based in reality and biological science, which is males cannot become females, is being impacted upon by trans awareness training, which is saying that very belief in my head is a hate crime.
Yeah, it's hugely problematic for me, that. Helen, you're going to want to reach down the phone and smack me in the face. That's probably unfortunate phraseology, considering we've been talking about violence, but I've got a big problem with the concept of hate crime, full stop. I did some segments on this programme about some of the speeches given by people like Stella Creasy and others at Westminster, you know, trying to legislate for misogyny and that. I've got a massive problem with it. And I've never, despite my own academic training in English and history, I've never been able to articulate very well what I mean by it. But I think it's very dangerous to be, you know, prosecuting a crime against a woman or against anybody and introducing the notion of hatred as a motivating factor and then, you know, tacking on an extra sentence. I've got a real problem with that. And again, you might want to, you know, shout at me for saying this and the floor will be yours. That doesn't empower women at all. That disempowers women. I don't like that, Helen. What do you think?
Well, funnily enough, women aren't actually protected by the hate crime laws. Although we are protected
not
by
yet.
The Equality Act, we have rights, but we are not protected. And actually, trans women are protected because trans is one of the things that's protected. So actually, in that sense, a trans woman has more rights than a woman because anything against a trans woman would be seen as a hate crime. Whereas if it's sort of like common garden misogyny, it won't be seen as a hate crime against a woman. So there you go. There's the difference between women and trans women.
Yeah, but not yet. But if the likes of Stella Creasy, whom I don't have anything against, I dislike politicians equally, no matter which party they're from or which gender they are. But if they get their way... And look, this is where I come from on this. For me, it's kind of like a decades-long kind of creeping totalitarianism. And again, creating more and more identity and vulnerable groups. You know, I don't think strong women would really... A crime against the woman is a crime against the person. It's a crime full stop. And introducing this notion of hate crime, I don't know, it goes down a very bad road. Like I said, I struggle to articulate it. For me, it's all very Orwellian. You know, the motivation behind it, a crime is a crime. You know, and again, you're delving into areas of thought crime. Like, I've had women say to me, Richie, there are men who hate women. We know this. There are women who hate men. We know this. What difference does it make? You can't legislate for that. You cannot possibly legislate for it. I've grown up with guys, Helen, who I know have not looked upon women very favourably. You know, they don't think women are worth very much. But these guys are not violent, never would be violent, and go about their lives, and they have relationships that don't last very long, and they go on about their lives. But the idea that you can try and tackle their dislike for women in some way, again, look, feel free to shoot me down here. I just find it all very creepy. Go ahead.
I don't particularly want to talk about hate crime against women because I think that the very reason it's not a hate crime is it would absolutely swamp the courts with, you know, I think there's a lot of crime against women. Two women a week are murdered by ex-partners. I've already mentioned the sex crime statistics. If you look at the difference between the number of women in prison and the number of men in prison, you can see that there are a lot more men who are violent. There are a lot more women who are victims. I wouldn't necessarily think that calling that a hate crime would make any difference.
It's horrendous. It's a horrendous thing to hear that. And those statistics are right. You're absolutely right. And introducing this sort of legislation is not going to suddenly increase or show an increase in convictions against people who beat women around the house, you know, night in and day in and night out, or men who kill women. It's not going to increase the prosecution rate against these people. You're absolutely right to make that point. And look, fair enough, we can leave that there because it's not what we came on to talk about. Helen, is there any legitimate and coordinated, again, I don't want to use the term fight back, but push back against this trans activism and groups like Mermaids? Is there any headway being made by groups of people to try and stand up
to it? There is, actually. I mean, one of the kind of good results of it is that there's been a complete resurgence in real grassroots feminist groups. There's a group called Fair Play for Women. I would really, really recommend their website. They go into things like the prisons and sport. They're very, very good on the science and the statistics. So there's a huge amount of information on their website. If your concern is children, then go and have a look at the Transgender Trend website. That has, again, it's science-based, it's facts, it's research, it tells you all of the things that the trans lobby groups don't want you to know about the effects of, for example, puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and the treatment of children. So go and have a look at that. A Woman's Place is a group that comes from socialist women, and they have had meetings all the way around the country. They've got a website with lots of good information on. And in all of those websites, you can see there are actions that you can take. You can obviously you can write to your MP, but there are particular things that you can do and particular things to look out for. A recent Woman's Place initiative has been to look at the way that an awful lot of councils, under the guise of being inclusive, have actually changed one of the characteristics of the Equality Act. And instead of putting sex as a protected category, they've put gender, and that's a huge difference. I don't know, do you know the difference between sex and gender?
I'm always asked this question by people who try to catch me out, and you know what, they succeed every time. Do you want to enlighten me again?
Can I tell you, sex is a biological immutable fact.
Yeah, that's
we
right.
are sexually dimorphic. It's male and female. That's all there is to it. We cannot change from one to the other. It's rooted in science. And gender is that gender actually used to be called sex roles, and that's a kind of easy way to remember it, because it's to do with the way that you present. It's your clothes and your hairstyle and your name, and it's also about the kind of things that society expects from you. So, you know, as a woman, I'm expected to be kind of kind and
right.
sensitive and you know, possibly a little bit subservient and weak even, and as a bloke you're meant to be strong and go-getting and a winner. Now those are very, very crude stereotypes, but and not all women, and not, in fact very few women and men actually adhere to those stereotypes, but you know what I'm getting at.
I do.
There's a whole load of ways that you can be a gender, but there's only two ways that you can be a sex.
And
the problem with when you say gender instead of sex, for example, there was a case a year or so back, I don't know if you heard about this, but in Topshop there was a man who, I think he was early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, a man who identified as non-binary, so neither male nor female, which actually I think we are all non-binary, but anyway, he identified as non-binary, wanted to try on a dress and wanted to try on this dress in the women's changing room and was not allowed to. He complained, and then Topshop changed their dressing room rules. So they're all gender neutral now.
Jesus.
To be more inclusive. Gender neutral actually just means mixed sex. And it wasn't even that this man identified as a woman. He didn't. He just didn't identify as a man.
As either.
So,
yeah.
So what we've got, so if we're looking at gender, now, you know, gender means that anybody who says they're what they think they are, how they identify, can go into a space. If you use sex as a marker, then only the person of that sex can go into that space. So trans lobby groups in the background, without many people noticing, have been quietly changing the marker on the Equality Act list, and all of our public institutions have a duty to uphold the qualities of the Equality Act characteristics in order to make everybody more equal. So,
but it doesn't work like that. This is the problem, you see. This is something I drone on about, and my listeners are sick to death of hearing me talk about this. The more that governments around the world try to make things more inclusive, the more exclusive they become, the more people are excluded and marginalised, because, you know, they will never, whether it's because of cultural or religious thinking or differences, will never think the way they are being told they must think. It's quite strange that, you know. Anyway, that's just my bloody take on it, Helen. It's a massively serious issue.
Certainly you can see here that instead of facilitating good relationships between people, there is a kind of heavy-handed bullying going on where, you know, the other stakeholders are not being given the chance to speak. And in fact, the trans lobby groups themselves use the hashtag no debate. And it's quite true. They do not want any debate because, you know, as soon as you start debating it, you can see how unfair it is.
Yeah.
So it's in their interest to have no debate. But that ties into what we started with, the fact that people are being, you know, cautioned by the police for misgendering. It's a way of silencing. It's a way of stopping people having the debate. It's a way of scaring people. They're also, at the same time as doing that, women are being chucked off Twitter, for example, and Facebook, for misgendering. It's another way of making sure that women don't have a voice in a conversation where they are actually the major stakeholders. I mean, you know, we're actually, you know, we're the majority actually as women. So, you know, we should have a say. And this is one of the ways of preventing that from happening.
It's going to run and run. I know that is a cliche, but it is. I've had trans folk on before, but they've been of the thinking that you've outlined in the last half an hour, and they're perplexed. I've identified some of the...
I'm sure that there's an enormous number of people out there who identify as transgender and absolutely hate what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are.
There are, and they come on. And when you get the hardliners who are trying to change the law and change society, they refuse to come on for the very reasons that you just outlined. There, we're just about out of time. But Helen, you can come back anytime you want. You don't have to wait to be asked, because I'm sure we'll be talking about this again soon. Helen's blog is Not the News in Briefs. That's briefs plural. notthenewsinbriefs.wordpress.com. And Helen is on Twitter. It's at Helen Saxby 11. I've enjoyed having you on, Helen. If you want to have the final word, we've got about 30 seconds there, because I did cut you short there, because we are just about up on time. But if you've got anything to finish off with, we've got 30 seconds to go. Back to you.
I'd just like to reiterate, if you want to find out more, go to Transgender Trend, Fair Play for Women, A Woman's Place. Go and find out what's going on and get involved. Go, you know, make your voice heard. If you don't want the ideology to continue, and you think that women should have a voice, then get involved. Do something about it.
Helen, thanks so much. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
The pleasure's been mine, Helen. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Godspeed. Look after yourself, and we'll talk again soon. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. That was Helen Saxby on the line there. Helen is a feminist writer and blogger. She's got a very interesting blog. It's Not the News in briefs.wordpress.com. Good to be talking about identity politics there as well. Enjoyed that chat, it must be said. A lot of tweets on it. Go to twitter.com where it says at Richie Allen Show. No, where it says search Twitter. That's the one. Where it says search Twitter, if you put Richie Allen Show in all one word, it will tell you, it will show you even what other people are tweeting to me, and you can get involved in a conversation. You can shout at one another and all the rest of it and have a proper go and all of that. Shall we get the headlines from FSN, shall we? It's a fast approaching 3 minutes past six for Monday, March 25th. We are in the year of our Lord, 2015. Is it the year of our Lord, is it? The year of Arnold, 2015. Right, over to Ollie Barrett. I'm guessing it's Ollie anyway, at FSN with the headlines back in 30 seconds.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Russian President Vladimir Putin's spokesman says Russia's ready for better relations with the US after an investigation found no evidence of collusion between President Trump and Moscow. Two rival parties both say they're going to be able to form a coalition after Sunday's tie election. Chinese President Xi Jinping's visiting France, the final stop on his European tour. And the EU says it's growing more worried about the health of the Italian economy.
Cheers, Ollie. Appreciate that. Ollie Barrett there. Keep those tweets coming in. As I said, Tony Gosling is going to join me in a couple of minutes' time. Bet you didn't know, because the time flies, bet you didn't know that the 4th of April, that's next week, I think, is it? Maybe not next week, is it 10 days' time? April 4th will see 1 year since the Skripals were poisoned in Salisbury. If you believe that one, I'll tell you another. Where are the Skripals? We will talk about that. Tony Gosling and I, terrific journalist and host of the politics show on BCFM. That's Tony Gosling. He'll be with me in a couple of minutes. As I said, live from Bristol. In the meantime, we'll just crack on. I might have some music. I will go to the tweets in a second as well.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Helen Saxby. Top stuff. Very good writer, by the way, if you read her blog. Very, very good writer. Faisal, how you doing? Faisal, making women's changing rooms, Richie, more inclusive by allowing men into them sounds like a line from Porky's, says Faisal. It does, we shouldn't laugh. But yeah, it does sound like a line from Porky's. Miss Balbricker, Get her upstairs. Lassie, get her upstairs. In This Together tweets, yes, the idea is truly tyrannical. It's going. They're talking about the European Union there. I'll leave that alone for a minute there, yeah. We've had enough of the European Union there. Patrick says, Helen Saxby made a very good point. I'd not really thought about it. What is that point? Mawinga tweets, I don't think most women have given it a thought that trans women get more rights than natural women. Patrick tweeted that, yes, it was a good point from Helen Saxby. I hadn't thought of it that way either. Well, the law is that if you identify as a woman, or if you're a man who identifies as a woman, or a woman who identifies as a man, well, that's it then. That's good enough. You know, and society better get used to it. And nobody should misgender you and all the rest of it, yeah. Not good, is it? It's not good. At Richie Allen Show on Twitter, Cartoon Drunk says, here in Thailand, women are not allowed in any Buddhist temple. Cheers for that, mate. Excuse me. I have to scroll right down because, as I said, quite a lot of tweets came in. David tweets, the hammer of tyranny is now coming down hard. We've known that it's been coming. But has anyone asked what the true agenda is for? Is it possibly the introduction of something not obviously wholly human? Asks David. Cheers, David. I appreciate that. Hi to Paul Paranite. How you doing, Paul? Richie, I saw a doctor saying that the difference between men and women is on a chromosome level. There might be a gender identification issue, social or mental. Social or psychological, Paul means, but actually until the chromosomes are somehow in flux, gender is decided by nature. But identify as you wish. I suppose some people listen to programmes like this and they hear a guy like me with a big booming voice and a big ignorant baldy head. And because I'm in my mid-40s, and they automatically assume that your politics is on the right. When of course mine isn't. And they make assumptions that when somebody like me says, I really genuinely don't mind, and I'm not impacted by somebody in my inner circle identifying as a member of the opposite sex, I actually mean it. It's not virtue signalling. I couldn't care less. Why would you care? If a friend of yours says, you know, identify as a woman and I'm going to wear women's clothes, fine. And I'd like to be called Claire, no problem. Whatsoever. Why would there be an issue with that? You know, whatever makes you happy. You know, life is not a rehearsal. Does that make you happy? Fair enough. Good luck to you. And that's it then. It's when people start to impose or try to impose a way of thinking and behaving on you and tell you that you have to believe that black is actually white and white is actually black. And you're like, well, I know that's black. I know it's not white. I know it's yellow. I know it's not pink. I can see it's clearly yellow. And somebody who's got male genitalia telling me that I have to believe that he's a woman is not going to wash with me. Ever. And I know I've said this a million times, but that's where it is. 8 minutes past the hour. Shall we get Tony Gosling on, shall we? Let's do it! Love chatting with Tony Gosling, top man, the host of the politics show on Bristol's BCFM, former BBC journalist. While we dial Tony up, let's have some Snow Patrol. This is Chocolate. What a tune this is. On Europe's most listened to independent radio show, The Richie Allen Show. Yeah, you gotta love Gary Lightbody. Snow Patrol there on the Richie Allen Show, 10 minutes past the hour. It's glorious outside the studio, looking out the window there. That is glorious. Unbelievable. Apparently we're going to have 17, 18 degrees here in Madchester later on in the week. Yes. I won't be making any excuses. I'll be here every day this week, Monday to Thursday. Tony Gosling is a legend. You know Tony very well. The presenter of the brilliant politics show on BCFM in Bristol, the man behind Bilderberg.org, former BBC journalist, and he's a great sport because he jumped in today, short notice, which a lot of people in Tony's position wouldn't do, but he's a great sport. Loads to talk about thisweek.org.uk. I know you know that, but if you haven't been on there before, get on there. Tony, thanks for coming on, mate. How are you?
I think you're peddling conspiracy theories on this programme if you're talking about it not raining in Manchester.
I know, yeah, yeah. It's been lovely, and apparently for the rest of the week we're going to get kind of unseasonably warm weather. It must be global warming. Now,
well, let's hope something good is going on anyway. We deserve a little bit of cheering up. Actually, I've noticed just people on the streets the last couple of days have been quite with a bit of a spring in their step. It's lovely this time of year, isn't it? When you get a bit of an outbreak of a bit of warmth and sunshine, it just cheers everybody up.
Everybody's in good form, yeah. Spring has sprung. Now, thanks to me inviting you on last minute today, I realised, but again, only thanks to you, that next week, or the 4th of April, it's amazing how time flies doing this particular job, and you've done it for years, so you know better than anybody. The 4th will see a year since the Skripals collapsed inexplicably in Salisbury and were attended to by a chief of the army medical person, and then were spirited away to hospital. Mad Tony, let's start with that, because
this is the first thing. Actually, before it even happened, you've got the chief of the army's, the most senior nurse in the whole of the British Army, almost certainly, you know, close connections to the intelligence services, is there on the scene. And what does she do? She sends her daughter in with no kind of protection whatsoever to deal with a nerve gas attack. So, I mean, you've got to question as to whether she really believes it's nerve agent involved, if she's sending her daughter into the middle of the fray to deal with it. So, I mean, the whole business of the Skripals, I think, is unravelling and unravelling. It sometimes takes months. But then, of course, it falls off the news agenda. The news media aren't interested anymore. The basic facts, like, was this bottle of perfume, which was supposedly used to apply this deadly chemical to the door handle, why did it then get found back in a sealed bottle in a sealed container again? I mean, were these Russians so clever they had some little cellophane device to seal it all back together? These basic kind of things aren't looked at. I think, I mean, there's another narrative that's been emerging the last few months, Richie, and I'm sure you're aware of this, and that is that there is a fascinating explanation for Bellingcat's interesting little revelation that there was another seat booked on the plane back to Russia, where these two guys were supposed to have come over to Salisbury, which they obviously were. They were photographed in Salisbury, and there was another seat booked back on that plane in another name. Now, the obvious conclusion here is that that person may have been Sergei Skripal, and he may have been planning to go back. In fact, there's an article in The Independent, as soon as this all happened a year ago, well, it's just over a year ago now, and The Independent saying that he planned to return to Russia, which most people just scooted over that. But it was in The Independent. It was quite well, you know, known that he'd expressed potential, you know, going back to Russia. Now, that's the sort of thing you might not necessarily do if you're a spy, especially if you're a former spy that's been involved in creating this completely fictional Steele dossier, which was used to try and bring Trump down during the last election campaign. So it's not the Russians interfering. This is MI6 interfering in the US elections. So that seems to me to be the most likely explanation here, is that the two guys turned up in Salisbury with a false passport made out for Skripal with his picture on and a false identity, and he was planning to go back to Russia and spill the beans on what MI6 and the Western intelligence services have been up to. But of course, once MI6 got wind of this, they would have had to take some pretty drastic measures to stop Sergei Skripal going back and making, you know, an immense amount of fun on the TV over in Russia. But the other thing I've been looking at since all this, Richie, is Novichok. What is this stuff? No one had ever heard of it beforehand.
No.
Except, by the way, in a couple of TV dramas which had aired just a few months before this attack. I think it was just before and just after Christmas, each side of the Atlantic. It popped up in some drama series. No one had ever heard of it before. Anyway, it looks like, I mean, my digging around, I don't know if you come across this, but it looks to me as if Novichok is a complete fake. It doesn't actually exist. And it was set up by the Russians back in the Cold War in the 1970s and 80s as a fake load of documents which were given to someone they suspected of being a NATO spy in order to see whether the Western intelligence services would get hold of all this information of a supposedly new type of nerve agent. What it was, apparently, was a whole load of sort of chemical, you know, it's like a formula, you know, the traditional formula we see in films, spy secret formula.
Wow.
But if anyone was an expert in organic chemistry, they'd look at all that and they'd say, well, look, this is rubbish. That actually doesn't make sense. But anyone who was an agent might look at it and think, crikey, this is really important. I'm going to pass this back to the West. And so that's, I think, now, that's what Novichok was. It didn't actually exist as a real chemical agent. It was just basically a fake document, a fake chemical, which was used to weed out who were the NATO spies within the Russian structures. And so that is, I suppose, there's not much else of use for that other than to see who is stupid enough, who is inexpert enough to believe this. So that's where I'm at, looking at what Novichok is. I don't think it doesn't even exist as a real nerve agent.
Now, why wouldn't the Russians have said that themselves, what you've just told us there? Because what you've told me there is plausible enough to me. The Russians should surely come out and say that.
They don't say anything more than they have to.
Right.
That's the way these things work, I think. And they're just waiting to see who is going, if anyone else is going to realise this. I mean, I think because the tension is now ramping. I mean, we've had a massive number of scores of diplomatic expulsions because of this and a ramping up of tension. That really, I think, the real reason for that ramping up of tension has nothing to do with Novichok or Salisbury or Skripal or anything else. It's all to do with the Russian success in stopping the NATO and the West's plans and the Israeli plans in Syria to kick out President Assad. The Russians have stopped that. And so they've got to find some sort of way of getting back at them.
Tony Gosling is our guest. That's a really interesting theory, that. It really is. And I've had tweets on this. When you come on, we get reams and reams of tweets, of course, coming in. In this together, I love my Twitter pals with their lovely names. Didn't the Iranians synthesise Novichok, Tony, from the book formula in 2016 and hand their work to the OPCW? Because we had, this could all be misinformation, but we did hear about the possibility of buying a book on Amazon with the ingredients for Novichok. I don't know. I like your theory, to be honest.
It's feasible, but the thing is, these things get passed around, and only when someone who is a qualified chemist has actually made the stuff and tested it do we actually know if it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly know that nerve agents, which were originally developed as based on organophosphates by the Nazi scientists during the Second World War, and then greedily taken up by the Brits and the Americans after World War II, and then, of course, once one side's got it, then the other side's got to have it. They've got to develop antidotes. We've got things like VX, and they quite clearly are. But the other thing, of course, about the Salisbury story, why this doesn't make any sense, is that this stuff is incredibly deadly, allegedly. And if it had been used on the Skripals, Yulia and Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, they would both be dead. They weren't dead. They were paralysed in some way, and they were delirious. So this looks to me like some kind of chemical.
Hallucinogenic or something.
It seems to me that is what was used on them. Of course, if Sergei was about to try and go back to Russia and spill the beans on the Steele dossier, and that was another really important angle on this story, of course, is Alex Thompson, bless him, from Channel 4 News, telling the world that there was a D-notice on, I mean, of course, there's also always rumours, but, you know, when we've had it from Alex at Channel 4 News, we know, I think, that there is a D-notice on Pablo Miller, who was the guy who was Sergei Skripal's handler. So they are happy for everyone to know all about Sergei Skripal, but the intelligence services here in Britain don't want anybody to know about who was controlling him, who was moving, and which side he might have been on. So that's another angle on this, you know, that does make you very, very suspicious about, you know, is he really just acting on his own, or is he about to turn back to working for the Russians and MI6 have just intervened and said, you ain't doing that. Forget it, mate.
By the way, Tony's on, of course, just for our listeners who don't know, listening overseas maybe, a D-notice is when news organisations are given an official request not to talk about something or not to publish something on any particular subject in relation to national security. Here's a question for you. Love when you come on, because we segue off into different places. How often do you think D-notices are handed to our mainstream media in this country without the knowledge of even intrepid investigators like yourself. How often do you think that goes on?
Yeah, I mean, remember, there's really only a handful of editors that are given they're actually called DA notices, Defence Advisory Notices, and the old term is D notice, but that's still what's used. I mean, the other big question here is, why would an editor not just ignore it and say, I'm going to publish this anyway? Well, the answer is because they will never get any information from the Ministry of Defence or from defence sources again, or at least certainly they'll be put on the blacklist for a few years. So they are very much aware that if they go against what they're being told, that they will be completely frozen out from the sources that they need for their daily news. I would suggest, yes, you're probably talking about every few months something like this being issued. It's just quite rare, and it's real big pat on the back to Alex Thompson for, you know,
ignoring.
I hope I don't get him sacked for saying this, but you know, big pat on the back for him for sharing it, because most of the time they look at it and they go, okay, well, we can't talk about that. It's really just a 1984 style censorship instrument. So when there's something really important the public need to know, they will say, of course, oh, it's all national security, which is just bunkum. In fact, another reason apparently that you can issue a DA notice is if it's to do with finance. So if it looks as if there could be big financial implications for the country in saying something, then no matter if it's, you know, that Britain is involved in some massive international fraud, you can't report it because a DA notice has been issued to stop you.
I want to, just before we move on, I want to mention this. Just give me 25 seconds here, Tone, please. Tony Gosling is the presenter of the politics show on BCFM in Bristol. When I say that it's a magnificent programme and it's brilliantly produced and it's eminently listenable, I mean it. I wouldn't say that, and I very rarely say it about anything. I've known Tony since my days in Spain 10, 11 years ago. He's a fantastic presenter and producer, and his programmes are fair. And when he claims to have some information, he can back it up with hard evidence to prove that what he is saying is true. When it's conjecture and it's supposition, Tony will always flag it up and say, well, look, this is what I'm thinking at the moment. A short time ago, a group calling themselves the UK Lawyers for Israel took exception to Tony's programme and made a complaint to Ofcom, the official, which is the regulatory authority for broadcast media in this country. It could have been it was serious, but it could have been very serious for Tony, whose work is impeccable. It's shot through with brilliant journalism and reporting, and there isn't an ounce of racism or hatred or anything like that in his work. Thanks be to Jesus, Ofcom saw through the spurious and ridiculous claim by UK Lawyers for Israel, and they found in favour of Tony's programme and the radio station BCFM. You must have been a little bit worried, mate, because that was serious stuff. I mean, the implications for that, for Ofcom saying, oh, well, we'll uphold the complaint, the implications were pretty shocking for you. I was so thrilled that you won that, and I know you move on from here, but have you got a quick word on that for us, Tony?
Well, first of all, I gave Ofcom quite a lot of help. I mean, I spent 3 days or so doing a submission to Ofcom to explain why the programmes were not biased against Israel and were not biased against MI5. And I also did a complete takedown, because I was rather disappointed that Ofcom took seriously the idea that a programme was dealing with conspiracy theories and that could possibly be a breach of their code.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the term conspiracy theory doesn't actually mean anything. What we're talking about is a term which was invented by the CIA in 1967 to stop criticism of the Warren Commission and to stop journalists looking into the death of President Kennedy. The term means what you're doing, using the term, is you're mixing up real conspiracies with fake conspiracies. And so actually, the term you really should be using, if you're looking at what we do, is investigative journalism. But no, they're saying, what we do on our program is look at the moon landings being faked. We look at the British government being controlled by lizards. We look at all sorts of other silly ideas, which we don't. What we're doing is a fairly serious job, I think, in trying to weed out the rubbish and ignoring it generally and looking at the real conspiracies, because there are real conspiracies, people making billions. I mean, one of the ones we were looking at this week is to do with Lloyds Bank, which are alleged, not by me, but by the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley Police, Anthony Stansfield, to be involved in anything up to £1 billion fraud, but they haven't been prosecuted. Now, this is a potential real conspiracy, and that's what we're interested in. You know, Bristol branch of some bank, which is defrauding people, and the police aren't investigating it, allegedly. You know, so this term conspiracy theory, I was really disappointed to see Ofcom took that seriously. At the other end of the complaint, though, it was really interesting to see, just as our verdict came out, a publication on Mondawise's website, which was a brilliant takedown of UK lawyers for Israel, really explaining that the genesis of this little group was nothing more or less than the Israeli Foreign Ministry itself, and that there were, it's all peppered through with all sorts of suggestions that the people working for it now is some sort of front, effectively, for the Israeli government. So I was quite shocked to see that it was a direct, you know, this is certainly what it looks like, a direct threat against what I'm doing here in Bristol as in terms of journalism from the Israeli state itself.
But it
was. Most of that money.
It was.
Sorry?
It was. Listen, yeah. some listeners might think, oh, that's a bit much. No, it was. I've looked at this particular group myself. This is a group directly influenced, controlled by elements of the Israeli government. There's no two ways about that. You're absolutely right to say that.
Yeah, and people are obviously sympathetic with the Israeli state. Now, let's just remind ourselves who and what the Israeli state are. They are now a extreme racist fundamentalist state that is involved in systematic demonization and hate speak against the entire indigenous population, which is the Palestinians. You know, this is not very neighborly for people to turn up as migrants from other parts of the world and to, I mean, really what there should be is a massive boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign in the same way as we had in South Africa to get them back into line to stop the racism. And yet what we see is a very active racist state now trying to stop any criticism of it anywhere out in the world, particularly in the Western world. I mean, you'll find some parts of the world where the Israelis don't get such an easy time. One of them is New Zealand, where this Christchurch attack happened, by the way, and also in Malaysia, where Zippy Livni and other senior Israelis have been put on trial for war crimes and found guilty in absentia, so they can't go to Malaysia. I mean, admittedly, that the president there is a bit anti-Semitic. You know, he crosses the line there. But the fact of the matter is that there are people who are criticising Israel, but there are very, very few of them in the Western world. And, you know, I just think it's so important that this happens in order to put some pressure on the Israeli state to stop the racist attacks on the Palestinians over there, because it's getting really crazy. It's also being fueled by poisonous hate speech by Christian Zionists in America, particularly. There's this guy called, John MacArthur? I don't know if you've ever come across him. He's makes John Hagee look like a puppy dog. And he basically says that the hero of Islam and the Muslims and the Hadiths, which are a bit like the Talmud in Judaism, which are kind of, you know, writings of the rabbis or writings of the mullahs, saying that the Mahdi, who is the great hero of the Quran in the end times, is the Antichrist. So what they're doing is they're planting in many Christian, deluded Christian minds that they've got to just kind of kill Muslims and stop Muslims. So this is really fueling this diseased sort of minded attitude of the racists in Israel. And there are, I mean, there's an election campaign going on there now that actually encourages them to think that Muslims are the Antichrist followers, you know. So this kind of stuff really needs to be called out, I think, and at the very least discussed, because it's not being discussed anywhere in Western media as far as I can see at all.
No, I mean, it comes up all the time on this particular program, and
look, I mean, we've had everything from ISIS, haven't we? We've had all this stuff about the caliphate, and this is all this is being used to recruit people. We've had all that, but we haven't had the other side of the coin at all, and so that's one of the things I've been trying to do.
Two issues that, if we can stay with this for a minute before we talk, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Christchurch in a sec, but before we do that, two things. The Israeli Defence Forces said 7 people were injured, British Israeli family in Tel Aviv because of a rocket. Netanyahu has got problems, domestic problems, of course, investigations going on there. He said there'll be a heavy response. It's been 5 years since the so-called Operation Protective Edge. Some would say that Israel is due to bombard Gaza again. Please God, it won't happen. But on that, what about this phenomenon of the far right, kind of, you've just touched on it there, merging with Zionists? This is really interesting because traditionally the far right, particularly in America, blamed Jews for everything and hated Jews and openly discussed hating Jews, and Jews were the devil and all the rest of it. What we've seen in recent years, even in this country, with the knuckle draggers, whose name I won't mention, kind of aligning themselves with Zionism. Strange times, Tony.
Well, look, I mean, we had a guy called Mark Smullyan, who's a Jewish musician here in Bristol, on our programme on Friday. He's anti-Zionist, he's Jewish. And there are millions of Jewish people out there who are now looking at the state of Israel and saying, good God, you know, how do we stop this? And of course, they're not. They're generally, I mean, many, many Jewish families are actually very left-wing, and they don't agree with the racism.
Absolutely.
But the thing is, how do they stop it? How do you stop it when you're not actually given an airing? This is why I do everything I can to get, you know, Jewish people on the radio talking, ordinary Jewish people, rather than the Zionists, who seem to me to be the epitome of this term fundamentalist. They absolutely believe that God has given them this land to do what they want with, and also exclusively to them, so everybody else has to go by one means or another. So this, I think, is a very dangerous way of thinking, you know, and the speech that goes with it is got to be called, just as, you know, many of the Muslim hate preachers were called, hate speech. And this kind of thing just needs to be, it certainly needs to be challenged. I mean, I don't think you should actually ban these rather poisonous pastors from saying what they say, etc., but it needs to be challenged in the mainstream press, and the mainstream press is just simply not doing their job. And if they don't do their job, then it's going to inevitably, I think, lead to some kind of crisis. But we've got to make it absolutely clear, Zionism and Judaism, and even just ordinary, you know, this whole term Jewish to define a race of people, completely separate things. Zionism is this fanatical, nationalistic and very right-wing thing. In fact, by the way, of course, I don't, you probably know that Tommy Robinson in this country, his court case was funded by Zionist institutions.
That's right.
So they are very, very much involved in the far right. Also worth looking at, do you remember Anders Breivik? I think it was 2011, the attack where he killed 70 people over in Norway. I think very similar to this thing over in Christchurch, because it was an attempt to take a peaceful country that's on the periphery of world affairs, that's trusted, whose passports are trusted, and that country is also used often in mediation around the world. Say there's some sort of conflict going on wherever it happens to be, India, Pakistan,
Oslo,
or whatever. We'll bring in someone from Norway or someone from New Zealand who's trusted to be a mediator to calm the conflict down. So New Zealand, like Norway, has now been brought in to this whole conflict by the act of a fanatical far right, you know, lunatic, basically someone who's obsessed, possibly even, I might go so far as to say this, Richie, mind controlled, possibly even programmed in some way to just hate people. I mean, I know one thing, he was really into these violent video games, and it seems to me he thought he was playing some kind of violent video game. Well, he got so obsessed with them that he decided to try and make it a reality. One of the things we looked at on Friday was the this whole thing of Netanyahu saying that, oh, New Zealand has that's a declaration of
war
on Israel.
That's right, yeah, do you remember that? Yeah.
And I mean, obviously New Zealand are not declaring war on anybody, except apparently in Netanyahu's mind, on him. Because the New Zealanders sponsored a motion at the United Nations condemning Israeli settlements on the West Bank and in Gaza and stealing land, which is a great thing to do, you know. But no, Netanyahu says, no, that's a declaration of war. Now, when Netanyahu says it's a declaration of war, does that mean he would justify sending some sort of special forces person in to kill people in New Zealand? I mean, who knows? But there's also been a long history of interference in New Zealand by the Israeli state, by the Mossad, by the intelligence services, in there trying to steal New Zealand identities. Now, by stealing passports and by stealing information, then applying for passports of New Zealanders, because they know that those New Zealand passports will allow their agents under false identities to go almost anywhere to do things like sabotage and commit assassinations. So there is quite a tense relationship over the last 4 or 5 years between New Zealand and Israel, which has been very much under the radar.
I saw quite a bit of the video. And it's my belief that even though there are some strange things going on in the video, it's my belief that the kid, I suppose he's not a kid, but he went in there and he began killing people. I've no doubt in my mind that's what happened. And, you know, I could be wrong. What concerns me, Tony, is having watched it a few times, is this character that keeps popping up in the video, the guy with the red coat on him, the guy with the red jacket. And I've looked at this several times, and I'm a huge skeptic, you know. People jump in the independent media with both feet, and they don't pause, and they jump to conclusions all the time. Not you, but you know the people we're talking about. Everything is a hoax, and everything is a false flag. Everything was a military operation. Hang on a second. Look at it. Dispassionately calm down. And I've kind of kept my powder dry, and I've had a good look at this over the last few days. And what I'm seeing in this video is one really glaring anomaly. And maybe this is the reason that they're talking about putting people in prison for sharing the video. And this is this guy who keeps popping up in it with the red jacket. And to me, and this is just conjecture because I know nothing about this type of thing. To me, I can understand why somebody might think Handler, right there. Who is this guy? Have you noticed this, Tony? Have you seen this in the video? It's rather strange.
I don't know. I think the guy's working on his own, actually. And the other thing is, I think that I love the way Jacinda Ardern has reacted to this by saying, no, we're not going to use his name.
I just think
this is such an imaginative, and it's brilliant that the New Zealanders have come up. They've got real leadership there with something that the Western, it doesn't even occur to any of our Western puppets, that she's saying, no, we're not going to use this guy's name. I would also say, though, that the knee-jerk reaction in banning guns over there is not going to stop someone doing this again.
No, but isn't that pathetic, Tony?
Just for the public.
Hang on a second.
Hang on.
I'm going to argue with you here now.
In the second mosque he went to, that I think it was incredible to see the people actually with as one or two of them weren't there, who are so courageous with unarmed, except with one of those little cash machine type things, to take the guy on, to pick up an empty gun and to threaten him. I don't know. I don't think there was a handler. As far as I can see, there's nothing there. Red jacket, I didn't see that.
It
looks to me like this guy is basically a Breivik character, the same kind of guy who has decided that Muslims are the biggest evil thing in the entire planet, not him. No, they are, and that he's just going to kill as many as he can, and he's been sent there to do that in order to try and traumatise New Zealand, to bring them into the much bigger war, which is, you know, is being fermented out there, essentially, you know, between Russia and the States, between Israel and Iran, and effectively a religious war centred around Jerusalem, potentially, into the future.
I go along with quite a lot of that, or most of it. I don't doubt the kid had some involvement in it. I'm not convinced he was on his own, but I completely respect what you said there. I'm going to argue with you about Jacinda Ardern. I think she's pathetic. I think the notion that you wouldn't use the guy's name is laughable and trite and tripe and pathetic. It could be that, well, let's forget all about this guy. Let's not look at the fact that he travelled in Pakistan, that he was in Turkey twice. Let me finish, Tone. I didn't interrupt you. Let me finish, then I'll shut up and I'll get out of your way. Hang on a second. She is completely shutting down any investigation into this guy, number one. And number two, all this hijab wearing, hugging Muslims and all that, that's just virtue signalling crap. People want answers, not virtue signalling prime ministers. Go ahead, Tone.
Well, look, where do I start? I think the idea that the press, I noticed straight away after Christchurch, were looking at him, his family, wasn't he a lovely little boy, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I think she's absolutely right to say he is not the most important person here. The most important person that we should be looking at are the victims' families, the survivors, all these people, some of them incredible characters. I think she's absolutely right to do that. And I think it's a model, in fact, for any kind of future terror attacks that happen. And of course, there will be more. That we do look at the victim end of things rather than
who could argue with you?
Because it does. This guy obviously did this kind of thing, wanting to be notorious, wanting to be feared, wanting to be well known. And I think she's done the right thing to to set the standard, really, to say, let's not, I mean, obviously, we're not saying don't look at, look at where he's been, what he's done, etc. But the idea that his name is used night after night after night, like we've had, say, for example, with 9/11 and, the use of bin Laden,
yeah,
you know, the
idea
of sort of whipping up this crazy frenzy around a particular boogeyman, there always seems to be one, doesn't there? I mean, for a long time, of course, it was Saddam, then it's Gaddafi, then it's Assad. This kind of thing, I think she's absolutely right to at least to make an attempt to stop that kind of demonization, or, you know, making people, I mean, massive figures in the international.
But I don't believe, Tony, that's her motivation. I don't believe that at all. I believe that this guy's movements were key to the lead in that 2-3 year period that led into him doing that, particularly that 43 days he spent in Turkey.
You're absolutely right. The other thing which is key, which has come out about this, is that he was in touch online with Breivik.
Yeah.
So Breivik, in jail, is running his little poisonous far-right Knights Templar network of crazy Christian Zionists in order to encourage them to do this sort of thing, potentially.
And how could that not be monitored, this guy Breivik speaking with this guy? It's incredible.
What the hell are the Norwegians doing allowing him anywhere near the internet? You know, most people in prison shouldn't, you know, don't have access to the internet unless they bribe somebody or get a phone or whatever. But Breivik should be, the only reason, I suppose, in Norway they've allowed him to do this, and of course he had very, very strong pro-Zionist. The other thing with Breivik is he was a Freemason. People often forget this. There's loads of pictures of Breivik with his Masonic gear on, and they say Breivik was a lone nutter. Well, of course he wasn't. He was in a lodge with a whole load of Freemasons in a little secret organisation. So how you can dare say he's a lone nutter?
He was on his own, yeah.
He's beautiful. So why are they letting him anywhere near the internet? Absolutely unbelievable. And that, I suppose, is because they're trying to perpetuate the myth in Norway that he was a lone nutter, and therefore it doesn't do any harm to allow him on the internet. The Norwegians have got to cut off his internet right now, and there needs to be a massive organ. I think all the Western intelligence services need to make sure that nobody from the far right is allowed anywhere near these kind of poisonous. I mean, who knows what sort of stuff he was sharing? I don't know. I think
who
most
knows,
of the
But you and I both know, and one of the reasons I do know is because of my encounters with people like you many moons ago when I started to, you know, move away from commercial media. You know that it's often highly plausible and it's often suspected, and there's often circumstantial evidence, at least, that the very intelligence agencies that we would have cracked down on these guys are often the ones who control their minds, or whom
perpetrators.
This is the thing.
Okay, so there is definitely a wish in all of the Western intelligence services to have pieces on both sides of the chessboard. Okay, so they want to control people on both sides. Now, to what extent those people that they control on each side, I'm talking really here about the far right, Islamist extremist divide, right? To what extent are they using those people to gather intelligence, and to what extent are they controlling them? To what extent are they mind controlling them? To what extent are they actually puppets of those intelligence services doing what the intelligence services tell them to do? There isn't any checks and balances on this at all. I mean, we know this in Britain. It's just simply not happening. With the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is chaired by Dominic Grieve, his committee is hopeless at getting information. They find it very difficult to get intelligence officers to even come to the committee to answer anything, and then it's all done anonymously. So really what you're talking about is a kind of permanent government with the intelligence services able to do pretty much what they want, and then run a kind of a covering operation, a holding operation, in order to try and cover it up. But you're quite right. I think that's exactly what's going on. You've got some players are just being used by these intelligence services for their own purposes, without any real checks and balances. And the media just seem to go along with whatever rubbish story is being cooked up to make an excuse for this happening. But I think that the whole Christchurch business is a bit of a wake-up call, I think, and for many people, and for many intelligence services around the world, will be getting pressure on them to say, well, you've just got to take this far-right threat more seriously. This guy, apparently, is not even on the radar when it comes to the Australian or the New Zealand intelligence services. That's what we were told anyway. I find that extremely difficult to believe.
We couldn't believe it, yeah. Again, because of the guy's movements, North Korea, Turkey twice. He was in Turkey when there was an attack on Israelis in Turkey, incredibly. Sibel Edmonds has done some pretty brilliant work on it, to be fair to Sibel. I've had her on the programme talking about it. Got to give her a shout out there. Final word on this then, Tony. You and I have spent many hours on the radio over the years talking about the, I don't want to use the term fallout, but what comes about as a result of these shootings, and it's often increased security. We're hearing things. I've got a friend, Tony, who works for a council in this country, and he's a great source of information, really good guy, and I've got to protect him. You know, I don't have many sources like that. I'd love to say I've got all these sources buried all over the place. I don't. I know you have quite a few. I don't. I've got one or two. And my mate, who works at a council, has said to me, Richie, talks are at an advanced stage to bring in, not now, not in 2020, but maybe in 2022, 2023, to start zoning off city centres and access to city centres in the future only through use of a biometric ID card. So like you've got your Oyster card in London to get on the tram, you will have to have something similar, or on the subway, I should say. You've got to have some underground. You've got to have something similar to get into a city centre. And he says this is not being reported by anybody. The press are not picking up on it. But they want to basically zone off city centres in the future, and people will not be able to go down Market Street in Manchester. You'll get to Portland Street, maybe, right? He's not in Manchester City Council. He's further away from Manchester. But just as an example, you'll have to have a card to get from Portland Street to Market Street. There will be a barrier, and it'll be manned by a goon wearing a G4S uniform. And he's been telling me this for about a year now. What do you think? Final word.
Well, I mean, I think, yes, it's feasible. I mean, this whole thing has begun, I suppose, with the congestion charge in London.
Hey, there you go.
Particularly perverse, because it being something where poor people can't afford to go in their cars and rich people, it's nothing to them. So this is it. Will becoming, there are certain zones in the country which are becoming only for rich people. Now, I'm not saying no one can walk into central London, of course they can, but the idea that you've now got a tax which is affects the poor but doesn't affect the rich, you know, a regressive tax, they call it, don't they?
Yeah.
On entering parts of the city certainly seems to indicate that that is the sort of thinking that's going on. Like, this place is for us. If you go, if you speak to anyone that's worked at the European Parliament or the European Commission in Brussels, you will find they have a very similar sort of thing there. The entire place is a massive complex, which is completely sealed off from the outside world, with its own kind of shopping centres, with its own, everything, like swimming pools, this kind of thing. It's like a kind of city within a city, but it's completely sealed off from the outside world. This, I think, indicates the extent to which our politics has become completely removed from ordinary people, and also the mindset of the politicians that are making these decisions, that they are like from another planet, you know, they're another species or something, that they're not subject to the same laws as the rest of us. So they put those barriers there on purpose, I suppose, to assuage the guilt that the decisions that they're making are impoverishing those on the outside of the building.
By the way,
have we got a minute?
We have.
I'd like to just talk about the airliner, because I know
before,
we had a fantastic chat last year about the Lion Air crash, didn't we, on the same day that it happened.
That's
over
right.
In Indonesia, and we've seen this incredible, like, basically copycat crash.
Yeah, the 737,
ET-302. Exactly the same thing happened. So the pilots are flying the plane, they switch the autopilot on as they start to head for their destination. As they're on the climb, suddenly the plane starts to pitch forward all on its own. And then I heard this from someone at the weekend who's in aviation, that on the Lion Air crash, it hasn't been made public, and this is just from an insider, that they had an extra pilot who was just on board, who was shadowing, and he was frantically, as the plane was going down, going through the manual, trying to find out how to turn.
Yeah, I read that.
Autopilot. I mean, this is shocking stuff. And the idea that Boeing would not immediately ground that plane is just absolutely unbelievable. So what we've got now, and I think the reason, this is what I'm trying to get to, the reason that this has not been covered properly by the news media, and the reason that Boeing didn't ground those planes immediately, and they haven't done anything about this horrendous problem. If you wanted to, people are now, you know, wise enough, they won't get onto one of these things. Absolutely mad to get on one. And that's why they had to finally ground them, because the passengers were just refusing to get on them, which is a horrendous state of affairs, is because there are billions and billions riding on this technology, this autonomous control, self-driving plane, self-driving car world. There are billions and billions of pounds been invested in this, and yet we find it kills people, so we cannot use it. So this is what the massive denial, I think, Richie, from this crash, and the example of Boeing not grounding the planes, the Americans not grounding it. The EU, by the way, only grounded the planes after the British Aviation Authority did. Here, you know, the domestic one, and the Europeans then quickly, a couple of hours later, followed suit. They're in denial about this, and we need to make sure that passenger safety comes first again, because it's no good getting on a plane that's totally unsafe because somebody has got a load of money invested in Tesla and Elon Musk and these people.
Well, you can't make an omelette without killing a few hundred people, can you? I mean, we don't matter to these people, Tony. We never have done. We never will do. That's just about all we have time for today. Listen, first of all, thanks for jumping in last minute today. I really appreciate that, and I genuinely do. Second of all...
Anytime.
No, man. I love talking to you. And secondly, the Ofcom result was a massive result for yourself, of course, personally, but for everybody. For everybody else that creates content for programs and podcasts like ourselves, it was a huge result.
Not least the Palestinians.
Absolutely,
man.
Right.
They have such a hell of a time over there. Just in the same way as the racist apartheid in South Africa, the black people in South Africa had such a horrendous time. You know, there is exactly the same sort of situation. Actually, now it's actually getting worse for the Palestinians than it was for the black South Africans in the 1980s. So, you know, more needs to be done than we did for South Africa if we possibly can.
Yeah, too right. Thisweek.org.uk. Check out the politics show on BCFM on Fridays. If it turns out that you haven't, you don't know what you're missing. Terrific program. And Bilderberg.org, if you want to know all there is to know about a very important pillar of what goes on, is Bilderberg. Check it out, Bilderberg.org. Thanks, mate. I'll be in touch again real soon, as you know. Thanks for coming on, Tone.
Let me just put out a quick appeal. I mean, I've been chatting with various people about trying to figure out where this year's Bilderberg is going to be. We're thinking potentially Ireland.
Is that right? Wow.
Potentially, yep, because of what's been going on with the Brexit and the backstop and all that stuff.
Ireland.
So it's going to be in Europe, we think. So, and it's always around the end of May, beginning of June. But we're usually by this time of year, we've normally got a handle on it. Someone has leaked it, but not yet. So keep your eyes open.
Fantastic, Tone. Thanks, mate. Look after yourself. Speak again real soon.
Cheers,
Tony. Anytime, mate. The brilliant Tony Gosling there. Yeah, Ireland, that would be very interesting, wouldn't it? Somewhere in Kerry, maybe, or in Cork, possibly, if not Dublin or Belfast. It is 6 minutes, is it, to the top of the hour? Thisweek.org.uk, if you haven't checked out Tony before. The politics show on BCFM. Hugely important decision by Ofcom when UK lawyers for Israel made a complaint to Ofcom, the regulatory authority for broadcast media here, saying that Tony's programme is anti-Semitic and full of conspiracy theories about Israel. Ofcom Tony himself said, didn't he, earlier on, that he spent days working with Ofcom, giving them all sorts of information about his programme and the guests who come on it, many of them Jewish people, to talk about Israel and Zionism. And Ofcom, to its credit, threw out the complaint by UK Lawyers for Israel, which is a front organisation for Zionism, for the Israeli government. I'm not saying that these guys don't work and practice as lawyers. Nobody's saying that at all. But it's a propaganda wing of the Israeli government. Why would you want to be for Israel? You know, who could be for Israel? Be for Israelis, be for Jews. Jews have every bit as much right to peace, prosperity and happiness as you and me, as anybody else. And they're not a race. By Jews, we mean people who believe a fairy godfather in the sky. Jewish identity people have every bit as much a right to support in their quest for happiness and family and love and life and all the rest of it. But a state of Israel is something completely different. the government. It's a psychotic, racist, hateful, apartheid state, totally illegitimate, whose only basis for existing is that God told us that this land was ours. Did he? Did he? I wonder will that work for me. I wonder if I rock off on down to Tatton Park and square off 25 or 30 acres and say, this is the new home of the Richie Allen Show, and this is where the future Mrs. Allen and I will live because God said it was okay. And I'll cut all the trees down and tell everybody else to fuck off. This is my land because it's in the Bible. I wonder would I get away with that? Probably not. Anyway, that was a tad hysterical there. That's it for the programme. Massive thanks today to Helen Saxby. Thank you, Helen Saxby, for coming on the programme. Really enjoyed speaking with her earlier on about the trans activism and where that's all going. Not the news in briefs.wordpress.com. Helen's on Twitter. It's at HelenSaxby11. TonyGoslingThisWeek.org.uk. The Politics Show on BCFM. Again, check it out if you haven't. It's terrific. It's on every Friday. And if you miss it live, you can grab the podcast. I would put it in my must-listen list if I were you, if you haven't heard it before. That's it for Monday's programme. There's a grand stretch in the evenings, isn't there? I think it's this Saturday night, Sunday morning, that the clocks go forward here in the UK, meaning it'll be grand and bright next week when we finish up at 7. We'll be able to go outside and get a bit of fresh air and all of that. Finishing with a bit of Jeff Lynne, one of my favourites. You made a fool of me. See you tomorrow.